there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
This week happens to be Pollinator Week and National Grasslands Week at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And this is your welcome to On the Wing podcast presented by Purina ProPlan. So the last several years, we have celebrated Pollinator Week. This year, we're going to combo platter the bit and do a Pollinator Week, National Grasslands Week mashup. And to celebrate, you can check out all the content we're producing at pheasantsforever.org and quailforever.org. There'll be new pollinator and grasslands content each day. And we have a killer membership offer featuring the artwork of Ryan Kirby. There is a tremendous pheasant piece on the Pheasants Forever site, and as you would expect, a quail piece on the Quail Forever site. But I am going to get us rolling here by throwing it to a coworker of mine. And the catalyst for this conversation starts with a little girl and her dad. Take it away, Hunter.
Yeah. I took my daughter on her first bird hunt 2 years ago when she was 6 weeks old. I can still remember her tiny little head as I took her out of the car seat and put her in the little front pack carrier, and just the little kind of bald head sticking out of that. And she was so fragile and so tiny, and maybe we were crazy at 6 weeks old, brand new, to take her out into Montana's grasslands. But I just remember the feeling deep in my chest as she's right there, my wife's in front of me with my yellow lab, heading out into the grasslands of Montana. And just that feeling, I'll just never forget it. I can still feel it right now as I tell this story. Just her so tight and close to me, and just this amazing blue skies, clouds just kind of scattered across the blue skies, the sun shining, waves of grass waving in the wind, the opportunity to maybe get a bird, and my excited yellow lab just launching across the grasslands. We hung back and watched my wife go out and headed down the coulee and around. And that hunt lasted for a grand total of 15 minutes before my daughter started screaming, and I had to scurry back to the truck to get her some food and a change. But, you know, she'll never remember that hunt. She never will, but I will remember that forever. And that moment really kind of gave me some clarity around the work that I want to complete with my career. And I've always been passionate about grasslands in Montana, but that feeling right there is something I want to hold on to. And so as the Montana team has really promoted grasslands and made it our strategy and our priority within the state, that emotion is what I've been steering myself with. That feeling in my chest is a thing I hold on to when I say I want to make a difference for grasslands in Montana. And that's what we've really dedicated the Montana Grassland Initiative to, is promoting grasslands at scale to make the biggest difference we can through Pheasants Forever in Montana for grasslands.
Ladies and gentlemen, how is that for a podcast open? Hunter Van Donzel and the birth story of the Montana Grassland Initiative. On today's episode, I've got Hunter Van Donzel and three additional guests to help us put some color to the Montana Grassland Initiative. Those guests include Kelsey Malloy from the Nature Conservancy, Andrew Jakes from Wyoming's Migration Initiative, and Casey Sill, my co-worker at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. We'll go back to Hunter, and you can start with a quick background of who you are, where you're from, Hunter. And, you know, you have been on the podcast before, but we were sitting in a vehicle after a terrific hunt on Rooster Road Trip. So it's been a couple of years. Give our listeners a little bit of additional background on you and on who you are.
Yeah, I'm Hunter Van Donsel. I'm the state coordinator for Pheasants Forever here in Montana. I've been with Pheasants Forever now for just over 8 years and almost 4 years as state coordinator. I live in Helena, Montana these days, and I really provide, you know, direct supervision to our great team of conservation delivery specialists across the state, work directly with partners, and really align and strategize our strategic priorities and state strategic plan for the state.
Are you a Montana native?
Born and raised in Helena, Montana. Fell in love with grasslands on the High Line of Montana with my 7 years in Havre, Montana. I miss it. Feel like a traitor coming back to Helena here, away from the High Line. But yeah, Montana native.
And remind me your daughter's name.
My daughter's name is Harper.
Harper. And the story you were telling us to kick things off was Harper's story. How old is Harper today?
Harper is just over 2.5. She'll be 3 in August.
And Harper's not alone anymore.
No. We got a brand new one. We just had a son in February, just about 4 months old, and his name is Walter.
Walter and Harper.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That was
thank you.
A wonderful story. It brought the hairs up on the back of my neck. You know, just so passionate about the mission and leaving the world a better place. So thank you for bringing that idea to the forefront. That's what we're going to talk about today. Kelsey, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you connect to Montana's grasslands.
Yeah. So I actually grew up in Rhode Island, which has about 3 acres of native grasslands. I did a degree in wildlife biology at the University of Rhode Island, and then I wanted to go somewhere new, and so I went to the University of Manitoba in Canada for my master's and studied grassland birds, and I was interested in that because I wanted to learn about a new ecosystem, and I was also interested in the overlap of wildlife and agriculture. And so, yeah, after grad school, I moved back south of the border to Malta, Montana, where I've been for the last 11 years. And I've worked for the Nature Conservancy for the last 8 years. And my new role, I'm managing our grasslands program here. Yeah, and I'm very lucky because I am still on the High Line and right in the heart of grasslands in Montana. So,
what's the biggest difference between Rhode Island and Montana?
Well, there's a lot of differences, but probably the size. The county I live in now is like 4 times bigger than the whole state and has a tiny fraction of the people.
And what keeps you in Montana rather than moving back home?
Well, there's no traffic here, no stoplights. and honestly, I love that we have access to public lands here. I mean, Rhode Island has almost no anywhere that you can go hike. And so here I just drive 10 minutes from town and I can go explore millions of acres of grassland. So,
and tell us a little bit more about what you do for the Nature Conservancy.
Yeah, so we have 3 focal landscapes in Montana. 2 of them are in western Montana, and so our grassland and sagebrush landscape here we call our Northern Great Plains landscape, and so I manage that. And so that program has a couple components. We do protection work through easements. We own a ranch called the Matador, which we run as a grass bank. So there's 15 different families that bring cattle there and are able to get discounts on their grazing based on conservation they do on their home place. And then we have a science and stewardship component to our work as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
And how do you fit into the Montana Grasslands Initiative?
Good question. Yeah, so a lot of our work here revolves around partnerships, and there's kind of this larger partnership in this area with a lot of different groups. And so it feels like each group brings different tools to the table. And so, you know, we're more focused on some of the protection work and grass banking. And so Pheasants Forever has been a great ally in that they can then step in and do other projects. And so there's been a lot of connections where the different groups that are working will kind of share projects with each other. Like if we have a landowner who wanted to do a seeding, which I had happen a couple months ago, I was like, why don't you call Sean and Chinook? And they have a program right now. And so a lot of it's making connections. And so I am really excited that Pheasants Forever is elevating grasslands and that there's this big focus on restoring habitat and making new habitat. When when Hunter was in Chinook, we worked together on some projects, which was cool.
But now he's moved away to Helena.
Yeah, I've forgiven him.
Andrew, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, I also grew up on the East Coast. I'm an Army brat. I was actually born in Vicenza, Italy, and moved out here when I was about 25. So got almost 25 years under my belt in Montana. Have been all around the state, been to every single county, and kind of proud of that and learning about all the different communities across Montana. I'm actually based in Missoula, where I've lived the last 10 years. But as you see, I work for the Wyoming Migration Initiative. So it's a neat position that I'm in.
Yeah, that, you know, as I was preparing for this podcast, I did, you know, notice the difference there. We were doing a podcast about Montana Grassland Initiative, and your title came across as the Wyoming Migration Initiative Senior Director, Research Scientist. And, you know, it was intuitive to me, but explain how that fits into why you're involved in the Montana Grassland Initiative.
Yeah, so I've been a part of this larger community across north central Montana that bleeds up into Canada for, gosh, about 18 years now. And I've known Hunter and Kelsey and the organizations that they work for quite some time. And I was fortunate enough to work on a study on pronghorn migration, I'm sure we'll get into. But it's had tremendous impacts on how we think about movements and think about restoring habitats for a diversity of wildlife, not just ungulates like pronghorn. And so probably one of the leaders in thinking about migration in the world is this entity called the Wyoming Migration Initiative. Just for example, 50% of all pronghorn in the world are in Wyoming. So they've been thinking about things for quite some time, and I was fortunate enough to get on board with them. And I helped to facilitate research between University of Wyoming and University of Montana and helped to target research projects on the ground and implementation projects too. So that's how it came to be.
That was a really impressive stat that I would have never known. 50% of all the pronghorns in the world live in Wyoming.
Well, 48, but go easy on me.
So the obvious answer would be, as to why, would be there's the best habitat in Wyoming. Is that the right answer?
Well, there's just a lot of different ways that you can kind of cut that. There's amazing sagebrush landscapes. There's amazing open country there. There's not as many people in some of the potential impacts from development in Wyoming. And then you just have that cultural tie to management of wildlife and conservation in general. And I would say that's not only in Wyoming, but also in Montana as well, but and the other Western states. But yeah, it's just that open landscape that pronghorn need to thrive.
It's interesting because you talk about pronghorn and you instantly mention sagebrush. And that's where my mind was at with Wyoming as a bird nerd. You know, it's like, well, Wyoming's also the number one state in the country by a mile with sage grouse.
That's correct.
And it's no, no mystery as to the connection between those two species. It comes back to sagebrush, doesn't it?
It does. It comes back to habitat. And I think that's what this Montana Grasslands partnership is all about. And I know we're going to get into it, but that's what we're all working for as a community, is to restore and conserve that habitat.
Right on. Rounding out our conversation today, Casey Sill, co-worker at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, has very little connection to Montana. but that's why he's on this episode. He's going to be my co-host. Casey, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and why you wanted to co-host this particular episode?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Bob. So my name is Casey Sill. I'm the Senior Public Relations Specialist at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. I've been here coming up on 4 years. So I live in the Twin Cities area, but just across the border into Wisconsin, which everybody at the office likes to make fun of me about. But I'm not a. I grew up in Nebraska, so I've spent a large part of my life in eastern Nebraska. And I wanted to come on a co-host because Hunter and I have been working on the communications for Montana Grasslands Initiative for some time. It's mostly because he invited me out to Montana last October to sort of see what all the fuss was about. I had never hunted in Montana before in my life. Not only that, I'd never set foot in the state before until last October. And we figured if we're going to work together on helping celebrate the Montana Grasslands Initiative, that I should probably have experienced it firsthand before. So we took a trip out there mid-October last year to hunt shark tails, which I'd never done anywhere, had a pretty interesting couple days in the far northeast corner of the state. So it was an eye-opening experience for me. I had, I spent some time in western Nebraska growing up in the sand hills and stuff like that. So I was always so attracted to that landscape, but seeing northeast Montana is, I told Hunter, it's like the sand hills, but you turn the dial up to like 200 is just the, it's a cliche to talk about how big Montana is, but it's totally mm-hmm. true for somebody who's like me, who's spent their vast majority of their life in what I'll call the checkerboard Midwest of mm-hmm. like eastern Nebraska and Iowa. It's visually just kind of blows you away. So yeah. I was glad to get out there and see it firsthand as we keep sort of, going through the process of the Montana Grasslands Initiative and telling this story.
I jest about, you being the least connected to Montana, and I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
but I may be 20 yards further ahead in my experiences in that, I'm a youper growing up in the North Woods, where you can barely see 600 yards in front
right,
of you,
right.
rather than a mile. And the first trip to Montana, which was on the magnitude of 20 years ago, Jim Range invited me out. Some listeners will know Jim's name from the TRCP days. I was able to go hunting with Bob Marshall from Field and Stream and Jim Range and number of other folks. And it was life-changing to be able to walk over the hills and see the shadow of the Rocky Mountains. But you're walking in some of the most beautiful grasslands for pheasants. You don't know what your dog goes on point. You don't know if it'll be a pheasant, covey of huns, or covey of sharptails. It's a magical, magical place. So I'm thrilled as well to be talking about the Montana Grassland Initiative. I am so proud of Hunter telling that story of, how he had an epiphany carrying his daughter in his arms and how he wanted to make a difference for the future. And to be a little small part of that, being able to share it on the podcast is really, really gratifying. So let's get rolling. I want to first thank Purina Pro Plan, national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and a presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. All of my pups eat Purina Pro Plan, and they need to if they're going to run the Big Sky Country of Montana. Purina Pro Plan supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of our organization, and they have a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. You can learn more at ProPlansport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, introductions out of the way. Stage setting here, Hunter. Tell us a little bit about what your goal is, what you want folks to take away as we talk about the Montana Grasslands Initiative. Ultimately, we need to inspire people to do something different. Tell us the state of grasslands in Montana today.
Yeah, you bet. Montana has some incredibly intact grasslands that are incredibly significant for wildlife populations, agriculture, and rural communities. Yet with them being that intact, they're incredibly at risk, and they're at risk of conversion to different land uses, whether that's farming or energy or other development. There's also a lot of threats from conifer encroachment and expansion, invasive annual grass pressure, lack of management, and lack of diversity in some grasslands. We're losing hundreds of thousands of acres of grasslands in Montana, and we've had over 1.5 million acres of CRP lost from the program in Montana. That's almost two Vermonts that we've lost in grassland.
Say that number again.
Over 1.5 million acres of CRP has been lost from the program in Montana. Jeez. So, yeah, I think Vermont's just under a million acres, and so a Vermont and a half of land that we've lost. So, it's the scale of what we have, and that risk of it being lost is really critical in Montana. Whether that's for the wildlife species that you care about, of course, you know, we're here with this upland game bird perspective, whether it's sharptails, sage grouse. Sharptails in particular, percentage of grass on the landscape is the leading driver of population dynamics, whether that's nest success, the abundance of leks on the landscape. So for sharptails, particularly sage grouse as well, and also pheasants, intact, big expanses of grasslands are critical. And then you think about our rural economies, rural communities in Montana that rely on grass-based agriculture. Grasslands are just critical to the Montana way of life.
Okay, at this moment, I want to insert some audio from a video that, if you want to follow along, maybe you got your laptop up. You can go to the habitat page at pheasantsforever.org, and on the left navigation, you will see the Montana Grassland Initiative, and there's a video there. We're going to play 2 minutes of audio that gives you the entire overview of the Montana Grasslands Initiative. Give it a listen.
Montana's grasslands are disappearing. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, Montana's native grasslands have been cut in half, and nationwide, more than 50 million acres have been lost in the last 10 years. As these ecosystems vanish, soil health declines, more droughts occur, and ranchers face mounting challenges. This also affects wildlife. Grassland bird populations have declined by 43% since 1970. This threatens hunting, outdoor recreation, and the rural economies that rely so heavily on these pastimes. The Montana Grassland Initiative, led by Pheasants Forever, aims to conserve 1.5 million acres of Montana's grasslands and sagebrush steppe ecosystem. Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever are the nation's largest nonprofits dedicated to upland habitat conservation. With a community of over 477,000 individuals, we've dedicated more than $1 billion to 580,000 habitat projects, benefiting 28.8 million acres. The Montana Grassland Initiative has four key focus areas. First, protect 750,000 acres of intact grasslands through sustainable grazing, wildlife-friendly fencing, and conservation easements. Second, conserve 600,000 acres of vulnerable and degraded grasslands by managing invasive species, removing encroaching conifers, and restoring native plant life. Third, restore 150,000 acres of converted or altered grasslands with reseeding projects and incentives for grass-based agriculture. And fourth, expand 50,000 acres of public access. In just the first year, we've already seen measurable progress. Every acre impacted is a step towards a future where Montana's grasslands continue to thrive. Visit pheasantsforever.org to follow along and learn how you can be part of the solution.
All right, Hunter, you know, number one objective, protect intact grasslands. Number two, conserve vulnerable acres. Number three, restore converted acres. And number four is the access component, expand access. All of this involves landowners. How can landowners who've heard this get involved? What do you want them to do or know?
Yeah, I think the first thing is we want landowners and communities to know that we have overlapping goals with grass-based agriculture, and that we're one piece of the conservation community in Montana really looking to promote grasslands. And so we'd really love landowners to be, you know, to share their passion for their operations and grasslands and give one of our biologists in the state a call and really work with those folks. And we can provide, you know, connection to other partners like the Nature Conservancy, Wyoming Migration Initiative, Rancher Stewardship Alliance, or a suite of other partners that we work with to find, you know, the right partnership for partnering and collaborating on their operation and conservation practices. So we can deliver technical assistance on prescribing water infrastructure, seedings, grazing management plans. We can connect them to cost share opportunities through the Farm Bill. We have six staff across the state in NRCS offices delivering Farm Bill programs targeted towards grassland conservation. We work with any partner in the state that's willing to do grassland conservation. And so if we don't have the answer, we can connect you with the right person that can help with those overlapping goals of grassland conservation. So really pick up the phone, contact us, or contact another partner that's really looking towards grassland conservation in the state.
It's funny, in Kelsey's intro, you talked about partnerships and connecting people together. So tell us a little bit about, from the Nature Conservancy's perspective, how you plug into this initiative and what your perspective on vision for the future here looks like.
Sure. Yeah, so TNC in Montana in this landscape does do some like on-the-ground stewardship work, but there's a lot of stuff that we just don't have the staff capacity or funding to do. And so that's where it's really great that Pheasants Forever has this initiative, because if someone did want to do, like we have, when we do have funding, it's very specific to certain areas. And so a lot of times we're not able to work in other areas. And so when those producers reach out to us, we can connect them to Pheasants Forever. You know, I think as a whole, all the groups that have been working here have really made an effort to be strategic about how we're working. So Pheasants Forever is spearheading this grass reseeding and I'm not going to say this right, but like land rental for grass reseeding to help encourage producers to do that. And that's been a big need in this area, is that a lot of times landowners might be interested in seeding cropland back to grass, which is a huge win for wildlife because you're taking something that's not really habitat for most things and turning it into grassland habitat. But the economic hurdle there is that they don't get any income off of it for 2 years because it needs to establish before they can graze it. And so several partners had identified that this was an issue and we weren't really sure how to address it. And Hunter figured out a way to, you know, go pursue funding, mostly through NRCS, I believe, and be able to pay kind of some foregone income payments so that it's easier for those landowners to make that transition into grass-based agriculture. It's more just being able to collaborate where at the landscape level, various partners are looking at what are the needs and then who's doing what. So we don't all have to have a seeding program. We don't all have to have an easement program. We can kind of work together and say, well, who has the resources and expertise to get this done?
Hunter, what's the limiting factor for most landowners to get involved in conservation when it comes to, you know, efforts in Montana? Is it cost share? Is it necessarily historically competitive with rental rates or you know, to enroll in CRP from 06, 07, you know, before we lost 1.5 million acres? Is it some things are more complicated than others to get done? Like, what's the hurdle that you need to overcome when you're talking with landowners?
Yeah, I think I'm struggling to boil it down to, you know, what's the common bottleneck between all landowners. But I think it's a variety of some of those things you mentioned. I do think there's tons and tons of programs and partners that are working in some of these spaces. And so I think it can be a little bit overwhelming for some of these producers. And then just when you have an idea, having somebody else that you can bounce those ideas off of. And so some of the best successes I've had is just myself or one of our biologists, one of our partners really taking the time to care about that landowner, their operation, their family, the landscape, and bounce around ideas and then be able to follow that up and take it to the next step. I'm really thinking about one of the places me and Kelsey collaborated on, where had a landowner interested in doing some music restoration project stuff, and bounced around all these ideas, had some opportunity for farm bill funding, but I quickly realized that I needed some, you know, additional support, some technical support, and, you know, so reach out to Kelsey for, you know, one of the best grassland experts I know to really help me design and monitor that place. And I'm just thinking about that producer getting, you know, leveraging what I could bring to the table, what Kelsey could bring to the table, and just opened up this huge network. But we made it efficient where they only had two relationships to manage. They didn't have to manage 30 relationships and 30 programs. Me and Kelsey were really able to consolidate that, where we handle that behind the scenes. And then we're able to address all the bottlenecks, whether it's cost share, just new ideas take time to, you know, approach, and then making it easy to get on the ground.
You dropped a word in there that I would like to spend just a moment to define for folks. Mesic. Explain what that is from a biologist's perspective and why it's so important.
Can I have Kelsey explain that? Because she's the expert.
I always pronounced it mesic. Is the right way of saying it mesic?
I say mesic too, so.
Okay.
That's me.
Thank you.
It's a Helena vernacular, I guess.
All right.
So
mesic. Because I've always, this is a word that comes up all the time when you're talking with sage grouse biologists.
Yeah. We kind of use mesic as a sweeping term to mean kind of like the green areas in the landscape. But, you know, technically it's the area in between wetlands and stuff that's truly xeric or upland. So it's areas that are staying wet a little bit longer, but maybe don't qualify as a true wetland. So in this area, it's typically like coulees that maybe, you know, like in between hills, there's these drainages. And then along our streams, and a lot of our streams are ephemeral or intermittent. I was like trying to find that word. and so especially for sage grouse, but a lot of other birds as well, those are really important areas, because later in the growing season, like in August, everything else in the uplands is all dried up. And so those wetter areas or mesic areas are where you're finding both, you know, flowering plants and also a lot of insects, which are important for young broods. In this area, just thinking about pheasants, we also see that around irrigated fields where you see pheasants hanging out there, because that's where you still have moisture and therefore you have other food sources.
And therein lies your pollinator week connection.
There we go.
Right? Because, you know, our favorite birds, right? It ties back to the web of life. Over and over and over again, I've come back to the web of life. We all learned it in third grade and we've forgotten it. And if we just went back and learned the web of life, that it would simplify things so, so much more straightforward for everybody. But mesic areas, water produces insects. Insects are the food by which our broods of sage grouse, sharptails, you name it, survive. And everything is interconnected. And, you know, water connects the bugs to connects the birds. And boy, therein lies the benefits of protecting mesic areas and grasslands. So all that from one little definition of a term.
Yeah. And mesic areas only make up like 3% of the landscape or something. Like, it's a very small proportion of the landscape. So they're disproportionately important on the landscape.
Yeah. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I just want to throw in some more little factoids, right?
So, yeah, bring it on.
So
love
out
it.
In like eastern central Montana, we use a term, the ribbons of life are these mesic systems, right? And I think that 80% of all vertebrate species at some time or another use these ribbons of life to complete their life cycle requirements. So they're incredibly impactful for biodiversity and just taking that ecological approach towards restoration and management.
It's like tomato, tomato, whether you say mesic or mesic, they're, we're talking about the ribbons of life, and they're both, well, they are incredibly important. Go ahead, Andrew, and explain your perspective or the migration connection to Montana Grasslands Initiative and your vision, your vision for how this is part of, the future for pronghorn.
Yeah, and I'd even say it's not just the future of pronghorn, but just like wildlife management in general. Like going back to your third grade analogy, we all know that that we need habitat for wildlife management, and all animals need habitat. And I'd say also all animals must move. You have to be able to move between these seasonal ranges to really get those ecological requirements that are so important, whether you're a sage grouse, some kind of grassland bird or an ungulate. So it's really important that all animals have that ability to move. Moving just helps all these ecological processes. There's predator-prey dynamics that are involved. When you move, you're doing grazing, and so you're stimulating plant growth. You're dispersing like nutrients across the landscape. So it's incredibly important that animals have that opportunity to move. That's kind of the vision here as we talk about, the Wyoming Migration Initiative and just movement ecology in general. So I was part of a study in this North Central Montana region that actually tracked 106 pronghorn over 3 years, and just what do these animals need to sustain these migrations at the periphery of their range. So it's an important piece of this, this Montana Grasslands Initiative to consider movement and not just habitat. Both, really.
And tell us about, a little bit of what you learned in that study. Because I know, these herds, I mean, they don't care about boundaries between states or countries. How far are they moving?
Yeah, I mean, you just open that up to so our pronghorn that we collared made the longest migrations on record for the species. So over 800 kilometers within 1 year. Notable, the longest sage grouse migrations have also occurred in this area. And to your point that we were talking about before, we've done some analyses where we actually spatiotemporally overlapped where the pronghorn and sage grouse were moving and when, and sure enough, they're moving in the same areas and at the same time. So it is not just important towards one species, but many species. And yeah, we had animals go up into Saskatchewan, come back down into Montana, go up into Alberta, come on back down to Montana. So it really, when we think about management, we have to not just think of like that ranch by ranch scale, but we need to think at that broader level scale, which is what, the Montana Grasslands Initiative is all about.
That's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Cause I mean, that's the hurdle. Cause there's the property cut ups is based on different ownership. Trying to think about it from a landscape level, ecological, connectivity landscape from a pronghorn or a sage grouse, how many different landowners are we talking about to go from Wyoming across Montana into Canada?
Yeah.
Hundreds, right?
Yeah. And that's why partnerships is so important because, we each bring something to the table. And I'd say the number one thing that comes across here is trust. You're involved with the landowner. You make this relationship. And you work towards something together, which each of our entities has been able to accomplish over the last 10, 15 years since this relationship has been together. So that's super important. The other thing here is that livelihood is being considered. So grasslands are the most imperiled terrestrial ecosystem in the world, and we all depend on grasslands for food, for sustainability. And so we really all depend on those ranchers and make sure that their operations are viable. So we want to continue working with them. And they want to stay out there on the landscape. They're out there for a reason, right? And so they understand, and we've had enough conversations if we can be beneficial to your operation it's also going to be beneficial to the wildlife and the ecosystem holistically. And so we're finding these places that we're on the same page and we can help support one another for our ultimate goals.
You talked a little bit ago about these mesic areas being connections, ribbons of life. In terms of the migration patterns of sage grouse and of pronghorn, in that analogy of a ribbon of life, I'm thinking that they go from mesic area to mesic area to mesic area as they move north and south in their migration. Is that an accurate way of following, or is it too simplistic?
You know, sometimes the easiest answer is simplistic. So, I mean, by far and away, pronghorn, and I would say sage grouse too, they're selecting for native grasslands and native forbs and native prairie in general. You can see that they're actually, most of the time, I'll just speak for pronghorn, but when they're moving, do they use open ag fields? Yes, they do. And there's some certain reasons for that, but they move through them very quickly, where they can gain the highest protein content and feel the most, you know, safe is through those native prairie systems. And so that's happening both during their spring migration when they're moving up to drop their fawns. That's happening on fall migration when they're moving very quickly down to winter range. That's so important for their survival. And then I will say, because we're at the northern periphery of the species range, both pronghorn and sage grouse have been shown to make these extra, what we call facultative winter migrations, where they'll move from one winter, like seasonal range, to the next one just as quick as possible, because if they don't, then their chances of survival dramatically decrease.
So I find myself wondering, it's relatively intuitive why a species would migrate south in the winter, right? And they get away from the harsh elements. And, you know, it's somewhat intuitive. You think about waterfowl migrating north to prairie pothole region or prairie Canada to nest in the, you know, some of the best wetlands on the continent. It's not as intuitive to me why pronghorn, why sage grouse move north in the springtime. What's the biological reason? Is it, are they trying to escape hot temperatures, humidity? Why do they move north to, you know, drop their fawn?
Yeah, so I'll just sum it up like this. There's this idea, and it's true. It's called surfing the green wave. So really where you're having the highest protein content in your forbs and in your grasses is when that growth is very first starting. So actually animals will follow that green wave very slowly, very methodically, so that they can take advantage of that high protein content in those grasses, in those forbs that are coming up. And so you see it a lot of times, like elevationally, like if you're in intermountain grasslands, you'll see that the elk go way up, you know, up high in the mountains and drop their calves, right? It's the same thing here, except it's longitudinally. So they'll slowly move up into Canada, drop their fawns, and they typically drop their fawns where they've been successful before. So they want to keep going back to those places where they've been successful, and that's where you have a lot of high-quality forage.
Wow, that's awesome. Casey, I see you have a question, and then we'll move to Kelsey. This is spurring some conversation here.
Yeah, so I'm interested in sage grouse migration, being, again, a complete newbie to all of this. Why is it that, as I understand it, not all sage grouse migrate, right? So why are some migrating in certain areas and other ones staying put?
Do you want to hit that, Kelsey, or do you want me?
Sure, yeah, because that was going to be my comment, was about sage grouse, because you're right that these pronghorn are migrating, but that's actually not as common for sage grouse. And so in a lot of areas, sage grouse will just make small seasonal migrations. Like they might move, you know, 4 or 5 miles from their lekking breeding site to where they're brood rearing on these mesic areas and then go back. And so Montana or Canada actually is kind of unique. And so a lot of that is because of the habitat. So in southern Canada, there's a very small remaining sage grouse population. They're listed as endangered there. And the habitat is actually silver sagebrush in a grassland landscape. And so predominantly the landscape is grasslands. with a small sagebrush component. And so in the winter, if you have a lot of snow, all of that gets covered up and they just don't really have the food source. And so that's mainly what's driving that migration into Montana, is that, you know, in that big winter of 2011, which is when a lot of this research was happening, they went all the way to the Missouri River breaks, where there was areas that were cleared out from snow and they could access sagebrush. So it's just kind of a, being at that northern edge of the range, the habitat is different, but it is pretty unique because most sage grouse are not flying that far or doing that many migrations, because these birds are probably making a migration from breeding to late summer and then doing another migration to winter. So to me, these large scale initiatives like Montana Grasslands Initiative and the work around pronghorn is super important, because Montana bears a lot of responsibility for maintaining Canadian populations as well. And then a lot of our grassland birds, you know, go all the way, some of them go all the way to South America. So if Swainson's hawks end up back in Argentina in the winter, like, that's on us. They have to survive their time in Montana. Yeah, so we have a huge responsibility to, like, the global populations of these species.
Well, it's startling when you think about that. I mean, whether it's the monarchs or, you know, a bird that travels from, you know, Canada all the way to Argentina, you know, wildlife is just remarkable how, you know, they're willing to survive. But we have to be a critical component in helping them do that through habitat. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say something, too, that might be important is so when we're talking about migrations and in general, like, it's basically what's called partial migration, where some individuals in a population or herd migrate and some don't. And that can switch, that can change year after year, the different proportions, right? And so they are at a population level, they're kind of figuring out what's going on in the environment, right? And so they're selecting for certain, you know, habitat or foraging opportunities. But then importantly, there's also a piece where it's a learned trait, where some things are passed down from mom to the offspring. And that's really important as we think about how we allow animals to continue to move across these different native systems, because if they become fragmented or if they become cultivated, then it's going to be harder and less sustainable for animals to move to where they want to, or where they've learned that they could generationally.
Yeah, you become they become islands of populations in and of themselves, and then their biological DNA starts to get constrained, and that's a bad fate for any population. The curveball question for you, Andrew. You know, we are constantly mentioning the ungulate known as pronghorn. And there's probably a lot of folks saying, why aren't they calling them antelope? They're not actually antelope in the United States, right? The correct term is pronghorn.
Yeah, you can blame Meriwether Lewis and William Clark for that.
Is that where it came from?
I think so. I think it's from some of the earlier explorers. If it wasn't David Thompson, it was Lewis and Clark. It was one of those early explorers, right, that they came out and they saw this swift-footed animal, and, you know, they've heard about antelope before in Africa, and so they called them antelope. And that's fair, you know. Taxonomically, it's incorrect, but that's okay, you know. So that's where the term came from.
What's their closest relative in North America?
Oh, in North America?
There isn't one.
No, right? No. I mean, so actually, if you like look at a cladogram, you know, like a genetic tree, right? It's actually a giraffe. So
that's amazing.
It's amazing. Right?
It's like it's a species unto itself in kind of taxonomy.
It is
in North America.
There used to be a lot of different species of Antilocapra. Now we're only down to basically one with some subspecies. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting and unique species in the fact that it does have a horn. So it's actually an extension of the skull, right? Like a bighorn sheep. But they can actually shed the outside keratin sheath every single year. And so with antlers, those are shed every single year, right? But with horns, yeah, they're not. They just keep growing. But our pronghorn, the only ones that actually can shed their sheath and, I guess, part of their horn. So that's yeah, what makes them and other things. They're pretty unique and special species.
Yeah. Yeah, I love all the little factoids we're dropping today. Go ahead, Hunter. Connect the dots here from upland bird perspective beyond sage grouse. We've talked a lot about pronghorn, a lot about sage grouse. Bring sharp tails and huns and pheasants into the mix.
Yeah. Well, I think the big thing to keep in mind is what we're trying to do is make a really meaningful impact to a biome, right? The grassland biome. And so we're really setting this up beyond species and just thinking about grasslands as a biome and how to really restore, protect, and enhance that biome at that level. And I think integrating all those factoids, all those perspectives from partners, all those communities into that is really critical. And so if you think about the ungulate movement, one thing that Andrew's talked about and others that really stuck with me is an ungulate doesn't have the luxury of flying and hopping over to different patches of landscapes. And so if you think about true connectivity of grasslands, well, from an ungulate perspective, they need to be able to walk across that between patches. And so that's really critical in our strategy, and really this, you know, we're copying strategies and plans from partners out there and adding our voice to that and making it connected for all species. And if you add humans or sportsmen into that, you know, we need to be able to walk into those landscapes as well and feel connected. And so I think, you know, our vision for the Grassland Initiative is how can Pheasants Forever bring our network, bring all the things that we're so good at and all the things that we can leverage and add our voices into this great grassland work that's already happening. And of course, we're going to be thinking about huns, sharp tails, pheasants, sage grouse, all the things that we really care about, but they're only there because that biome is functional and we really need to invest in the biome as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, right on. That is the word of 2025. It comes up on almost every podcast these days, whether it's Working Lands for Wildlife, the Green Glacier. We had Dirac Twidwell from the University of Nebraska on recently. You know, we got to start thinking, as Andrew mentioned, landscape level, biome level, back to the web of life from third grade perspective. You know, it's all the same philosophy here. I know that there's lots of listeners. You're probably, there's listeners that are binge listening as they're heading out to, dog training, or maybe they're listening as they go to a hunting trip this fall. And they're like, oh, boy, this is a wonky episode. A lot of habitat talk. Where's the hunting connection, Bob? And I'm gonna throw it to Casey. And Casey's been to Montana once, but from a traveling bird hunter's perspective, bring us home from how you think about this and why. Why this initiative has moved you so much, Casey?
Yeah. Well, when I went out last fall, there was two things that really stuck with me. And one I mentioned earlier was just the scope and size of the habitat that so blew me away. This is kind of a tangent, but I felt like when I was 21, I went to Chicago for the very first time. And it was the first time I'd ever been in a real city. And I was such a hillbilly that, like, I thought the buildings scared me almost. They're so big and grand, right? Mm-hmm. And there were parts of that trip out to Montana where you come up over a rise somewhere and it gave me that same kind of feeling, like the back of your legs get a little bit weak, because it's just, you feel very alone and open. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really visually striking. But the part that really stuck with me is, once we kind of dove in and started hunting, I kind of wandered around like an idiot most of the time. Like I forgot I was hunting. It's just you're so surrounded by not just the scope of everything, but mm-hmm. the history. I'm big into history, and I know Andrew mentioned Lewis and Clark earlier. I grew up a stone's throw away from the Council Bluff where Lewis and Clark first interacted with native tribes. So I kind of grew up around that, and it's so easy when I got to Montana to imagine what it might have looked like 200 years ago, right? And that really stuck with me. And even more recently than that, you know, there was one evening hunt where Hunter was up in front of me a little ways, and he called me and said, "Casey, come up here and look at this." And we sort of come up over this rise, and the whole, I mean, there's Montana laid out right in front of you, right? Mm-hmm. And down in the bottom of this little portion of ground north of us was a tiny little house that had been abandoned for decades, right? I'm sure. But I thought about what that would have looked like in 1905 or 1910 or something like that, and how formative the habitat was, and how sort of intimidating it would have been at that time to somebody coming across that landscape in a wagon, you know, to get to their house. And, you know, it was like teepee rings and all of these things that are still just branded into that dirt. Mm. And it's such a compelling case for conservation. I was there for a day, and you realize that you better make damn sure that this sticks around and that we hold on to this. Yeah. And that's what I came away from the trip with. The hunting was hit or miss for me because I shot terribly. But that's kind of par for the course last year. I had like the worst hunting season of my life last year.
Sometimes in the big sky, the birds look farther away than they actually are.
Man, I don't know what was going on. But although I will say that I was being too picky after the first day, Hunter's like, "Dude, just shoot. Like, there's sharp tails, it's late October, like, just take a poke at them." But it was an amazing time. I had so much fun. There was one morning in particular where we put into this piece of property, and it was really foggy, and we just sort of naturally, nobody even talked about this, but we sort of naturally just went opposite directions, and we all wound up by ourselves. And I was there with the dogs by myself, just working my way through this piece of property. It's just gorgeous and heavy, heavy fog. And then it lifts up, and all of a sudden you can see forever and ever. And it stuck with me as much as any like bird hunting trip I've ever been on, for sure. So, and it stuck with the dogs too, because they both got hit with porcupines on the last day of the trip, so I think they remember that one pretty well. So,
yeah. Well, it's better than a skunk.
That's true. Yeah, that's way better to ride home with than a skunk. Yeah. So, no, it was a wonderful trip, and I'll be back for sure.
All right, as we round third and head towards home, I'd like to go around the horn and have each of you going to help me put a bow on this conversation with, you know, closing thought, something that you want to underscore, simply, you know, something that, you know, Montana's grasslands hits you to the core, kind of like the Hunter's talked about and Casey's talked about. We'll start with Kelsey. What's your closing thought for this episode?
Oh man, I'm first. Well, my first comment is I was upset that earlier Hunter used Vermont as a unit of measurement instead of Rhode Island. but really, going back to what we're talking about, I just think that, you know, I'm constantly amazed by grassland ecosystems because they are really resilient if we can keep them intact. And they're kind of extreme landscapes in terms of weather and climate, you know. Where we are is very similar to Siberia. Like, it can get down to negative 40 degrees and up past 100 degrees, and the wind's always blowing. And the fact that anything survives here is kind of amazing. But we need to keep them here. And so we didn't touch on this that much, but, you know, the ranching community and those private landowners are a big part of that. We need them to be economically successful so that that grass stays in grass and doesn't get turned into other land uses. And grazing in these grasslands, you know, these grasslands have been grazed for 10,000 years by bison and elk and antelope, and so cattle are a great management tool, and, you know, the those ranchers and their cattle can be great partners in creating wildlife habitat.
Yeah, I'll throw it to Hunter, because I assume you want to jump onto that landowner connection and mention, you know, maybe some success stories or how folks can, you know, get connected to the biologist.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, that's so critical in our initiative concept, is partnering with landowners and investing in grass-based agriculture and really collaborating for a shared vision of grasslands across the state. And it's just so critical. You know, before I touch on how landowners can join, just something for, you know, the bird hunting audience to consider is, is sometimes we point grazing and livestock is somewhat of an enemy of where I can shoot birds in the fall. And I'd invite you to think about that differently. If you really look at the big scale of why a sharp tail is in Montana or why a sharp tail is in the sand hills of Nebraska, it's percentage of intact grassland on the landscape. There's been plenty of studies out of Montana that have looked at different grazing strategies, and really that fine tail grazing management didn't really move the needle for nest success or lek density on the landscape. And it's just percentage of grass there. And if we don't have ranchers and livestock on those landscapes, we're going to lose that grass. And so while some of that in certain years may look grazed more than you'd like it, it's still grass, and there's going to be sharp tails and sage grouse, especially because of that. So I'd invite bird hunters to look at that a little differently and see a cow is, thank God there's still grass here when they see that. And for a landowner, a rancher in Montana, you know, we want to collaborate. And, you know, you can find a biologist. You can either go onto our Pheasants Forever website. We have a Find a Biologist page there. We have 11 professionals scattered throughout the state that are more than happy to come out and do a site visit. We'll give you the information we can, connect you to the programs we know about and the partners we know about. I love it when I can connect ranchers directly with Kelsey or Andrew or many of the other conservation partners we have throughout the state. So does it mean we're just wanting to directly work with you in a silo? We want to open you up to that conservation community and really bring in all the networks and resources we have. So look for that Find a Biologist page and look for our Montana Grassland Initiative webpage built right into the Pheasants Forever Habitat page. So.
Cool. I'll come back to you at the close. I know there's a couple of entities you want to thank before we end the episode. Andrew, what are your closing thoughts as we close up this conversation?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I was listening to everyone, and I was like, man, what's it mean to me? You know, I could give kind of the what I think, you know, from my professional sense. But then, like, when I really come down to it, I want to think about, you know, how it's impacted me and then how I want to be able to, like, give back in a way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so I can explain it like this. So I live in Western Montana and I like to be outside. And when I'm walking around in Western Montana, I'm like, I don't know what it is. I love it, but I feel a little bit confined in a way, you know? Mm. When I go to Phillips County and I step out of my vehicle, I feel like I can actually breathe. And I don't know if that makes sense to anyone else, but it's this very calming, comforting feeling to me. And you know how they say, like, smell is one of the things that brings back the most, like, the sense? If you've ever been in a heavy thunderstorm and then you wake up the next morning, like, on the prairie, there's no better smell than, like, the first morning of the prairie. There really is. Mm. So when I think about that, my kids need to experience that. You know, like, that's what I think about. So I really want them to have that opportunity. I've taken both of my kids bird hunting before. And my daughter actually loves it more than my son, which it's awesome, you know. And so it's just one of those fun things. But I guess my parting thoughts are, when I was first thinking about this, is the word community. And I think about that from, obviously, ecologically, You know, it's such this diverse community that people don't think about. You know, one of our partners just showed this like root structure of native grasses versus like, you know, just like wheat like root structure. And it's like 5 times longer. And you can imagine all the very specific microbes and fungi and all the things that are in the soil. And that's, those are the kind of things that need to be conserved, you know, for these grasslands to stay intact and to be able to provide to not only us, but to the wildlife. But then also importantly, like the rural communities are just, they're just awesome. You know, it's like, they'll give back however they can if you're willing to just put in a little bit, you know, honestly. So I think about it from a human standpoint. I think about it from an ecological standpoint, but really there's nothing I've ever been a part of that, that you put all these things together and we're all working in the same kind of trajectory. So that's all I wanted to say.
It is. It's one of the, you mentioned you step out of the truck and you kind of look at the vista of Montana's grasslands and you pick your favorite spot in your mind. And it's really easy to take it for granted, right? And they get, oh, there's nothing here. It's like, everything's here. You know, whether, you know, like you talked about the grass and then the root system that you can't see, what's the wildlife over the horizon? What wildlife isn't here, but absolutely critically needs what is here to get from point A to point C, right? The migration corridors you talked about, whether it's for pronghorn, for sage grouse, for a songbird that is absolutely dependent upon getting from Canada to Mexico by that grassland that exists in Montana. Everything is here, and it's still possible to conserve it, to protect it, to keep it the way it is. But we have to act because it's going away if we don't.
That's right.
Casey, your closing thought.
Yeah, you know, I think we all want to go keep being able to go back to Montana and hunt sharptail and huns and pheasants. But the conversation today is a great illustration of how much bigger this initiative is and how much more important Montana's grasslands are to beyond the pursuit of upland birds, essentially. They mean so much to the communities, like Andrew said, that are out there. And they're part of the soul of our country. Mm. They're filled with history and they're filled with mystery. And we need to be able to hang on to that. And this work is really meaningful in that regard.
Right on. They're filled with history and they're filled with mystery. It's like Eminem rhyme there. Hunter, the closing thoughts are yours.
Yeah, I'm just unbelievably excited about the future of what Pheasants Forever and all the great conservation partners we have in Montana can do for grasslands. Really an exciting time of amazing collaboration and shared objectives to move forward. We're just one of the many organizations already focused on grasslands in Montana and formally coming to the table to really try to make a difference. So I'd encourage everybody to, you know, learn a little bit more about our initiative at our webpage. And the work we're doing isn't just Pheasants Forever alone. It takes really a huge network of partners and supporters and some partners I'd really like to call out first is the Arthur Blank Family Foundation has just been a huge supporter at elevating the Montana Grassland Initiative and really setting a course for what we can do in the future. Also, we have amazing chapters, Pheasants Forever chapters in the state of Montana, and specifically the Headwaters chapter out of Helena has really stepped up this year and really contributed really meaningfully to the Montana Grassland Initiative, not only through funds, but helping us do outreach in a couple weeks at some different events. So really thank you there. And then just the, you know, suite of federal partners, NRCS, state partners, Fish, Life and Parks, and other nonprofits. Thank you so much, Kelsey and Andrew, for joining and being excited about Grasslands. And it's a joy to work with your organizations and you two personally. So that's all I got.
Yeah, right on, Hunter. I will again point folks to the Habitat page at pheasantsforever.org. You'll see about two-thirds of the way down is the tab for the Montana Grasslands Initiative page within the website. And you can check out the video, check out list of all the partners. It's a really meaningful effort that's being taken place here in the state of Montana to protect these critically important grasslands. And whether you're in love with pronghorn, sage grouse, sharptails, pheasants, monarch butterflies, or just big sky country, Montana grasslands are critically important. So check it out, Montana Grassland Initiative. Folks, Kelsey, Andrew, Hunter, Casey, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your time today for this episode of On the Wing podcast. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding all our listeners to always follow the dog, especially if your dog's going to Montana. Follow that dog. Always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.